In my interviews with trainees for the series, whether I was asking them about reasons to unionize, or whether they saw medicine as a job or a calling, or what factors were compromising their well-being, over and over again, I heard about educational debt. And you can see why. In 2021, the AAMC reported that average medical student debt was $200,000. About 70% of medical school graduates carry some amount of educational debt. And though medical schools that waive tuition because of large philanthropic gifts obviously get a lot of press, such gifts are rare. So how is educational debt affecting students' and trainees' lives? How should we conceptualize debt in economic terms? And how does debt impact trainees' career choices? I'm Lisa Rosenbaum, and this is Not Otherwise Specified from the New England Journal of Medicine. Our first guest today is Lyle Sah. She's now a fourth-year medical student at University of Massachusetts Chan Medical School. Lyle was born in the United States but immigrated to Korea with her mother when she was in grade school. She attended university in Korea and was studying law and economics when she took a biology class for liberal arts majors and fell in love with it. Because you can't change majors in Korea, she knew if she wanted to do anything STEM-related, she needed to move back to the States. So she ended up at SUNY Stony Brook, which was near some of her relatives. She thought she wanted to do a PhD in neuroscience, but then her grandfather got sick and her plans changed.
My grandfather was very sick, I guess hindsight sicker than we realized during my sophomore and junior year of college. And as the only adult capable of navigating the U.S. health system, basically, I was kind of in a pivotal or critical position in our family to help navigate and guide that situation. And this was during my like pivotal period of seeing all the bench work I was doing was important, but I really wanted to be at the forefront. It's such a buzzword now, but in the moment I was like, oh, this is a great realization I'm having. I want to be where the direct care is. So that was a very formative experience in witnessing how our health system, our society in general, to be honest, treats elderly adults. It was very disheartening, but it also lit like a small flame under my mind. It was a form of like trying to be as useful of a person in this society, but also having some kind of change, like wanting to change some form of it, and being naive and very, very optimistic. I was like, I can be part of that change.
As soon as Lyle had clarity about her dreams, however, she quickly discovered that her demonstrated scientific aptitude wasn't enough. She would need to take some gap years to boost her CV, and she would need to figure out how to support herself financially during that time. Here's what her pre-med advisors told her.
And they were like, well, luckily you were a bio major, so you have a lot of the requirements, but it seems like you don't have any of the experiences. And I think that took me a little bit by surprise, just because I wasn't aware of this like pre-med gang or like this pre-med posse or this pre-med track that unofficial people unofficially take for all 4 years of their college career. And here I was like entering my senior year, trying to squeeze in everything. I quickly realized I did need gap years, but how I was going to finance that, how I was going to realistically manage all of that in any capacity was kind of a daunting question. So I sought out as many scholarships as possible because requirements were done. I could start clinical experience. I could start volunteering more. I could kind of switch all. Those were all free. It was the not free part that I was worried about. And I think this was a moment that I still resent a bit to this day, is how narrow of a spectrum of scholarships there were available for people who didn't fit the stereotypical, and I don't say stereotypical with any negativity. I truly mean that the confines and the wording that these scholarships all had that didn't include like Asian students, or that it didn't include just purely financial in need students. There was always a and also blank list, whether you had to be like first gen, if you had to be of a certain race, or if you had to come from a certain state, if you had to live in the certain state for a long time. So it wasn't enough to be poor is the conclusion I came to at that point. And navigating that was kind of a very daunting and depressing period of, okay, I'm like poor-ish, not poor enough, but I'm not rich or rich-ish enough to pursue this gap year. And seeing my peers who were able to just go with any free internship that they desired or needed or fit their interests best, and me myself having to figure out a lot of the components from a very different lens of, is this sustainable? Am I going to get paid enough? Will the location be livable with the cost and budget I'm on? So there was a lot of nuance to the decisions I had to make.
But Lyle was determined to pursue this dream of becoming a doctor. And after being rejected for jobs at 19 different Starbucks, she ended up juggling multiple jobs. But she still emerged from the application process with significant debt.
I began by working, I think, as a administrative like assistant on campus, a tutor, a peer mentor. I honestly did everything that was kind of posted on the school campus's like job website / bulletin boards. At one point, I saw my Google Calendar and there were more boxes marked as work than classes. So I didn't want to sacrifice my grades, but I also knew that I needed to balance this well. Like, there was no room to mess up. I eventually, when I graduated, working two MA jobs, medical assistant jobs, and I still tutored like crazy. It was the most, with the education I had and with the time to compensation ratio, tutoring was the best option. So I just, anyone that needed anything, I would, even if I wasn't well prepped to tutor that subject, I would learn. I would teach myself that subject in order to kind of seize that opportunity. So that was a very interesting period where I learned way too much physics. I learned way too much marine biology. Like, I learned everything that I needed to teach people. So it was either, do you just give your dream all you have, or do you quit? And I was a little too stubborn and a little too naive to quit. And the application itself was like $50 per school and then like $200 for each school supplement. And it was, I think, more costly because I wasn't well aware of strategies and all these like advice and knowledge that you might have gotten if your relative, your parents, or someone in your close circle had gone through this process themselves, even if it was far off in the past. They would have been like, no, don't apply to like 80 schools, just apply to the ones that kind of fit this mold and like it, have what you're looking for. But I was just like, I need to increase my chances. I can't afford to do this again. I saw the odds stacked up against myself even before I had entered the game. So I was just scared into applying to as many schools as possible, which is not the way to go, people, if there's anyone listening out there.
She ended up spending $11,000 on just applying to medical school. She was accepted into several medical schools and knew she would get a great medical education wherever she went. So she based her decision on the financial aid they offered. She chose University of Massachusetts because of their financial aid package and also because they had the friendliest financial officer she'd ever met. But even still, it's been hard.
They have this sheet and they have this table and it lists out cost of living. And there's like housing, there's textbooks, educational fund, there's all these categories. And at the very end, it says, etc. And it wasn't clear in the beginning, but as I kind of progressed through the first and second years of med school, I realized that et cetera kind of, it, all my obligations outside of medicine as a daughter, all my luxury, small luxuries in life, and all these quality of life events, and that boiled down to, or had to boil down to, the et cetera column. And I think that stays with me every day, unfortunately, that life for me, or as someone who needs to live off of financial aid, we are kind of bound to that et cetera column. Anything that's not necessary is et cetera. And that was something very eye-opening for me to realize throughout my training so far.
Would you do it again, medical school?
No, I don't think so. That's very controversial. Oh my God. But no, I don't think I would.
Why?
I think there, maybe that was a short-sighted answer. But I think, I really think if I had a redo, I would choose like something else. But that, please, residency program directors, like, don't like quote me on this. Like, don't judge me for it. I love medicine. I think it's the most rewarding field. But as of right now, I totally see myself just becoming a chef. And I know that's not an easy path. I don't say that lightly. I know chefs are intensely trained and they go through a lot of sacrifice too, physically and mentally. I just truly love food and culinary arts.
I asked Lyle if she thinks that her peers would also prefer an alternative career path, whatever that may be.
I've definitely heard it from my peers. I don't think it's uncommon.
Perhaps the financial sacrifices involved, especially for people who take on heavy debt, only underscore the deeper trade-offs. Lyle questions whether all the sacrifices will really be worth it in the end.
It's frowned upon to not want to pursue medicine again. I will do whatever it takes to be the best possible version of myself in this field, this life. But if I had to redo it again, I think there's just so much sacrifice that goes into the field of medicine that is taken for granted. I think it's changing. It's definitely on its way of like medicine 2.0. Like it's in the process of becoming a more, you can be a person and you can be a doctor culture. And I've definitely have like assurance that that'll continue to be the case as I continue my training. But I think there's just so many other careers that you do get to develop yourself as a person prior to developing yourself as a professional. And I think that is something that I never considered because I was so fixated on my desire to help people that I think entering my like late 20s, I'm at a loss of realizing like, what makes me truly happy. It's, I think it makes me pause and think, what other fields are there that I can still help people have a rewarding life, but also take care of myself as a person too? And I really hope with all my heart that I can re-answer this question in like a decade or two and wholeheartedly say medicine is a field that you can fully love yourself and care for yourself as a person and a professional, but I just don't think we're there yet.
Lyle's wrapping up a research year and plans to apply to residency this coming fall, so she hasn't jumped ship yet. But despite her generous financial aid package and minimal money in her et cetera column, she'll still graduate with over $350,000 of debt. As hard as that sounds, our next guest, University of Chicago health economist Joshua Gottlieb, thinks about educational debt a little differently, as he'll explain.
So let me take a step back and think about what debt is, what educational debt is. So first of all, part of what my research has uncovered is just how good of a career healthcare is. Most of all, being a physician, but also other careers. Nursing has become a more and more lucrative career option. Becoming a particularly skilled nurse or a nurse practitioner, being at the top of that. And physicians also do very well. So if you look at where physicians sit in the national income distribution, you find that they're really very concentrated at the top of the income distribution. And so being a physician is a good way for someone with a lot of skill to put their skills to work and get rewarded for it. So with that in mind, what is debt doing? What is medical school debt doing? It is an investment that is allowing people who have a lot of human capital to specialize in a field where they will get a substantial return on that human capital, substantial financial payoff from spending their time, their energy, their effort on medical care. So from that perspective, I think physicians should think about the fact that the U.S. has such extensive student loan markets, such good credit markets, as an opportunity, as something that enables them to make the very significant investments required in time, in living expenses, and in tuition to achieve that potential. The negative side is that you have to pay it back eventually. The positive side is that you got the loans in the first place and you were able to go to school.
The opportunity to pay for medical education by taking on some amount of debt seems clearly superior to a world where that opportunity doesn't exist. But it still seems, from talking to people like Lyle, that the amount of debt some students are carrying is extraordinarily high. So I asked Josh whether, even though debt might be an opportunity, there's such a thing as too much educational debt. And if so, where to draw that line?
Let me ask the question this way. Are those medical school resources being spent in training people in the most efficient way? Right? So in the same way you would ask, we ask this question about health insurance all the time, right? When we subsidize care, are we subsidizing the right kind of care? Are we encouraging people to get useful care? Or are we encouraging them to get unnecessary tests and interventions that actually are not necessarily beneficial on net? We ask that question all the time. If you're talking about subsidies for student loans, you should ask the same question. Are we subsidizing investment in education that is valuable? Are medical schools spending that tuition money in an efficient way? And look, I think it's quite plausible that medical education is genuinely getting more expensive. It's incumbent on the universities, on the medical schools, to make sure they're spending those resources wisely.
Okay, so I think what you're saying, and I think I understand this now, is that asking, is medical tuition rising and is debt too high, is just the wrong framing. And maybe I should instead be asking, is medical education efficiently using resources? And I don't know if anyone knows the answer to the question or how we would begin to understand it, because to understand it, you would have to think about like how we measure the quality of physician produced. And I don't really believe that anyone knows how to measure physician quality in a more than superficial way. What do you think?
I agree that's the key question and that it's really hard.
Josh suggested we get at the question by thinking about primary care providers and the different costs for training an NP or PA versus a physician, even though there'll be significant overlap in the work that they ultimately do.
A key question here is, if you can train someone to be a primary care physician in 11 years, including college, medical school, residency, or you can train someone to be a primary care nurse practitioner in a lot fewer years, let's say 6 or 7 years, are those extra 4 or 5 years of physician training producing a much better healthcare provider? Is it worth it? That's the key question, at least when it comes to primary care. I don't know the answer to that question. I'm not sure anyone does for the reasons you've said. It's really hard to measure the quality of care, measure physician quality or healthcare provider quality in such a broad context. But that is the key question. And if it's worth it, then great. Then yeah, the debt is facilitating that training, allowing people to reach an outstanding career and earn money, which is money well spent from society's perspective, or maybe it's excessive for some purposes. And I don't know the answer to that question.
Yeah, as you talk, I realize it's really a philosophical question, because who is going to determine what makes for better doctors in the future? If I can imagine that if we started to have this debate, everyone would have an opinion about, you know, why their curriculum or pet project matters and why it's important to being a good doctor in ways that we'll never be able to measure.
The market should respond. The market should tell us if a particular type of training is more valuable than another. And I think what we're seeing is the market telling us that people who are getting training and specialization in a particular type of medicine, but without going through the full MD or DO rigmarole, are really highly valued in the marketplace, right? So that's NPs, that's PAs, that's CRNAs, that's midwives. The market is saying the prices that the physicians are charging to perform all of these tasks, do all this type of healthcare, are really high. And if someone else can do it with less training and do it more cheaply, that's something the market is saying it wants. So then it becomes a policy question of how much do we allow the medical schools to keep the, whether you call it the barriers or the standards, as high as they are, add these other requirements on, or do we say, okay, let's encourage training of all the people who can provide medical care in a particular domain in the most efficient way possible, but who don't necessarily have that full training as an MD.
I feel like what you economists do most fundamentally is just tell us that we cannot have everything.
No objection here.
As we grapple with these tough questions about resource allocation and how to best meet the needs of trainees and society, it's important to consider the role of educational debt, not just in undergraduate medical education, but in residency and beyond. Our next guest, who's asked to remain anonymous, applied as a medical student to a federal loan repayment program. They were accepted, which meant that following residency, 3 years of service at an underserved primary care clinic were required. The benefits of loan repayment programs are obvious. You get loan forgiveness and the chance to serve a population in need. Less obvious, however, are the potential downsides. Our guest, who I'll call Dr. B, is going to describe some of those downsides. I asked them to begin by telling us how they decided to apply for the program in the first place.
I learned about the program, the National Health Service Corps, in my second or third year of medical school. And I think I just received an email about it. I saw it as an opportunity to fulfill two aims, one being to help with the debt burden that I was facing. And two, I had always planned to care for vulnerable populations, to work in an underserved setting, and I envisioned doing so as a primary care doctor. And so this seemed like a simple choice to me.
And so what was the agreement when you were accepted? Like, what did it mean for you and your life?
Yeah, so I think when I was first accepted, I felt a fair amount of relief, because I thought, even though honestly the amount of money that is offered was not half of the amount of money I owed for my medical student loans, I did feel a sense of relief that I wouldn't have to pay off quite as much as I was originally facing. The contract to me seemed simple. Essentially, it says you will receive a set amount of loan forgiveness for payment for 3 years of primary care service in a National Health Service Corps approved site. And you will work at full-time capacity, a minimum of 45 weeks per year. And that was as simple as that. That was the sum of what was communicated to me.
And how much debt did you have, and how much did they offer to forgive?
So I had, about $350,000 of debt, which was at the time at an interest rate of between 5% and 8%. So had the capacity to grow to over $500,000 over 10 or so years. And the offer forgiveness was for $120,000.
How did you start to anticipate what was ahead of you?
I am someone who comes from a family without any doctors. It was quite a great pride, I think, in my family that I made it to medical school and was the first doctor in the family. That turned out to be a huge vulnerability when it came to this program, because although I did my rotations, everything that every medical student does, most of our rotations are spent in the hospital. So I actually had a fairly limited exposure to what the life of a full-time primary care doctor meant. And so when I entered residency of course, this plan to be a primary care doctor, I think I quickly realized that a couple of things, that the subject matter, the day-to-day tasks of the primary care doctor didn't quite match with my personality. I think I'm very much a depth person. I love to gather knowledge, to take a really deep dive into a subject, to become an expert. And the primary care task is a monumental and important one of being kind of jack of all trades. And I think I realized pretty early on in residency, being in the thick of it, in the role of the provider, that wasn't quite the match with my personality. And then on top of that, I was an intern during COVID. So I spent months in the COVID ICUs in a hospital that was at 10 times the capacity for their ICUs and their floors. There were, in that setting at least, and I think in many other across the country, COVID really revealed the fault lines of our healthcare system. And I think what has started to emerge and what has sort of continued to develop since COVID is mid-levels have taken on a huge amount of responsibility in the primary care setting, and particularly in these vulnerable community practices. And so what I saw in COVID and beyond was not a dearth of primary care provision, but actually a huge lack of specialist provision of care. And particularly because many specialists are offered, excellent compensation for their work, twice, three times as much as primary care doctors are offered. The draw to community settings and to underserved communities is a really, really tough sell for specialists. And so as a result, there was just a huge lack of cardiologists, pulmonologists, everyone. And I saw this huge need in exactly the communities that I wanted to serve. And honestly, it felt like this big turning point in my career.
Wow. Yeah. So in any other setting, that would be, I think, a thrilling moment to figure out what you're most passionate about and that there is a need for your passion and your expertise. But for you, the fallout wasn't purely joyful, I imagine. Can you talk a little bit about that reckoning for you, realizing you wanted to be a specialist and then also recognizing that you had committed to serve for 3 years as a primary care doctor?
So ultimately, when I had this realization, when I knew that the road I wanted to go down, I reached out to the National Health Service Corps, and I essentially, you know, conveyed to them what I've conveyed to you, you know, the need that I had seen, the kind of fault lines that had emerged in our system, and you know, we see still today, I mean, years after COVID. And, you know, what I stress to them, which is what I really, you know, ardently feel, is that my mission has not changed. My values have not changed. And I think that they're still quite aligned with their goals, the National Health Service goals, which is stated on their website, you know, to empower clinicians to serve the neediest among us. And so what I communicated was that, you know, nothing had really changed, but I felt that I needed to do this in a different capacity. And I was more than happy to serve in exactly the communities and exactly the clinics that they were interested in having me serve in. I was more than happy, you know, if that didn't work, for them to try to take out another loan to pay off the, you know, the relatively modest amount of money that they provided. But I felt like this was what I needed to do, and this pivot was something that I needed to honor for myself and for my future patients. And I remember the first time I tried to make this plea to the National Service Corps, and I just received a no, like the email just said no. And so I, you know, I kind of went back, I regrouped, and I actually made a plea to the board of the National Service Corps, you know, with the same details that I've described. And I again received this time, no, comma, have you submitted your paperwork verifying your training for this year period? And then I tried to call to see if, you know, that would help at all, if speaking to someone in person would help. So I think that first time is a quote that I will always remember. I communicated everything that I was sort of dreaming about, passionate about, so excited about my career. And the person said to me, quote, I recommend that you try to re-envision your dreams.
So then how did you proceed? Did you have any other options?
I reached out to them about trying to pay off the contract. I honestly didn't know where I would, you know, get the money from, but maybe I could take a loan out. I just wanted to know my options. And this is where I learned that to break the contract requires that you pay the amount that you borrowed, and then basically a tax. So it's something like, it's about like $5,000 per month of your service paid on top of what you owe, what your salary will be, and the time course that they demand this sum for is one year. Now, this is not a program that anyone would sign up for if they did not have major financial burden, which means that, and I think that they know, I mean, how could they not, that the people that are signing up don't have another option. This is an unbreakable contract because of the financial demand that it requires.
I reached out to the Health Resources and Service Administration, which oversees the National Health Service Corps Loan Repayment Program. I asked about the binding nature of the contract, the fee for withdrawing, and how they respond to participants in the program who decide, during residency, that they want to pursue subspecialty training rather than primary care. I was put in touch with a public affairs specialist, and this was their response. High-quality primary care services are needed in high-need communities more urgently than ever, and NHSC, which is the National Health Service Corps, clinicians provide invaluable health care to millions of people in these communities whose health needs may otherwise go unmet. NHSC program requirements are set by Congress because the goal of the program is to retain primary care clinicians in the nation's underserved communities. The statute limits the NHSC to, quote, primary health services, unquote. The specific service obligations for NHSC clinicians are established in law and noted in the contracts participants must sign before receiving their scholarship and loan repayment awards. So given the binding nature of the contract and Dr. B's financial constraints that make it impossible to buy their way out of it, I asked them whether they're still considering undertaking subspecialty training after these 3 years.
Yeah, so I think, the honest answer is I have not decided whether I will be able to go back for specialty training. And a lot of it has to do with just being in my mid-30s and having a family and not knowing that when I'm in my late 30s or 40s, whether I will be able to sustain the toll of training at that time. In terms of how I proceeded forward, so I think at that point, once I learned that there was no negotiating and that the amount of money that I would have to pay was just prohibitively high, I just decided I'm just going to make the very best of this. Maybe I will be a primary care doctor on the other end of this. Maybe I will be not in medicine anymore. Maybe, I don't know, but I would just have to take it one day at a time and do the best that I could. So, as a human, as a physician, it is my great privilege and honor to take care of anyone. And so I have tried as best as possible to be the doctor that I would want my family to be taken care of by.
I want to thank all of our guests today, both for sharing their stories and for pushing us to think a little more rigorously about the efficiency of our educational systems. I'd also like to thank our editor, Deborah Molina, our senior producer, Mary Rose Madden, and Blue Dot Sessions for the music. Next up, on Not Otherwise Specified, we'll be discussing mental illness among trainees. It's a tough topic and sometimes painful to talk about, but critical for us to better understand.
Ultimately, that didn't work out. I sacrificed my winter break, didn't see my family, studied for that retake on top of preparing for step one. And ultimately, I came back to school, took it again, and I failed it again. just a huge heartbreak. And, because I wasn't prepared for that, and because I had already started to feel this depression worsening, it became a point of no return. After that initial advancement committee meeting, it was my first time I actually really fully contemplated suicide. Because I just did not know where else to go.
I'm Lisa Rosenbaum. This is Not Otherwise Specified from the New England Journal of Medicine. Thank you for listening.